Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, coming up Monday, you know, Don't Ask, Don't Tell might actually be repealed this weekend, with more Senate Republicans embracing it now as a civil rights act. We will get gay and lesbian listeners to call in and tell us on Monday if this passes, if you will rush out and enlist. Also, online bloggers from left, right, and center in an It's a Free Country open thread on the air coming up Monday here on The Brian Lehrer Show. Right now, it's not just Friday. It's Follow-Up Friday, where we take a second look at some things that piqued our interest during the week that was. First up, remember when President Obama said this at his news conference when talking about the new compromise to extend the Bush tax cuts and unemployment insurance?
I think it's tempting not to negotiate with hostage takers unless the hostage gets harmed. Then people will question the wisdom of that strategy. In this case, the hostage was the American people, and I was not willing to see them get harmed.
And, of course, he's talking about the tax cuts for the middle class being held hostage to the tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans in the reasoning behind the compromise. But it struck us that the premise of that comparison might be a little off. You don't negotiate with terrorists unless the terrorists threaten to hurt someone, he said. But is that true? Unless the terrorists threaten to hurt someone, are you sure about that, Mr. President? Joining us now is Maki Haberfeld, professor of police science at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Maki, hi. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So President Obama didn't quite get that one right?
No, he did not, unfortunately. Actually, in 1976, a famous psychiatrist by the name of Frederick Hacker created a profile of terrorists. And terrorists who take hostages can be divided into three categories, according to Hacker: the criminals, the crusaders, and the crazies. And what we are going to see in the future, and we already had seen in the not-so-distant past, actually the type we refer to as crusader. In terms of their willingness to negotiate, they don't want to negotiate. They're not ready to negotiate. They don't take hostages to negotiate. And the expectations to survive are not substantial, if any. So from the tactical standpoint, it is actually a mistake to try to negotiate with crusaders, because eventually when you move in, you're probably going to see more casualties.
How does a hostage negotiation work? How do you change the balance of power?
Well, again, not with the crusaders. You can change the balance of power with the criminals and the crazies, because the criminals, their motives are usually for personal gain, for profit. So their willingness to negotiate is relatively high. They want to get out. They want a safe passage. So you can promise them something, because the expectation to survive is really, really strong. With the crazies, it's not always clear what they want, but the expectation to survive is strong, not realistic, but strong. So you can promise them things, but this is not what we have seen in prior hostage situations related to terrorists, whether it was Chechens in Beslan in the school, or Chechens again in Moscow in the theater. They go there to die for the higher cause. So the longer you stay with them outside in trying to negotiate, the harder it will be to take over in terms of if casualties, hostages, first of all, are heard by terrorists or by hostage takers by the moment they are already taken as hostages in terms of psychological impact. And then when you're dealing with terrorists who have no expectation of survival, the longer the time that passes, the more tired the hostages become, uncooperative because they're confused. Same goes for the terrorists. So when the final decision is made to move in, the casualties are usually higher.
But not all terrorists are suicide terrorists. I mean, and there have been big political debates even in 1979, when those American hostages were taken at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran,
yes.
And in lots of other situations where some people said you always draw the line in situations like this, and you say we never negotiate with hostage takers because that'll only inspire more hostage takers because they'll think they can get what they want that way. Other people say you have to look at the immediate humanity of the situation. And if you can do something to save some innocent people's lives, you have to give that very serious consideration. So that's a debate, right?
It's a debate, but not necessarily from the operational practitioner standpoint. You have to look at this from the strategic versus tactical angle. Of course, strategically, you want least casualties. You want as many people saved as possible. Therefore, it's very tempting to say, let's try to negotiate. Maybe they won't hurt people inside. But tactically speaking, the sooner you move, the better your chances are in terms of least casualties. It's true that not all hostage takers are crusaders or suicide terrorists, but unfortunately, based on the more recent events, I'm not talking 79, now I'm talking about, 2002, 2005, 2006, what we are seeing, and in my view, what we're going to see are more and more crusaders. And it's we never know 100%, but it's easily, it is relatively easy to find out what kind of terrorists they are based on their demands. If they start demanding, for example, the free Chechnya, it is obvious that it's not going to happen during the hostage situation. If they demand $1 million and a plane, that's a different story. So based on what their demand is, you already know who you're dealing with.
So based on your paradigm here, was the Republican Party holding the middle-class tax cuts hostage to the upper-class tax cuts? Were they the crusaders, the crazies, or the criminals?
I'm a criminologist, not a political scientist. But, I see crusaders only in actual life and death situations. So everything else will fall, in my eyes, in between criminal and crazies.
Good answer. Maki Haberfeld, professor of political science at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with Follow-Up Friday, where we take a second look at some things that piqued our interest during the week that was. And in discussing the Virginia lawsuit against the Obama health care law that a federal judge ruled in favor of on Wednesday, that is, he ruled in favor of the lawsuit declaring the individual mandate to buy health insurance unconstitutional, we got an interesting call about the federal government mandating owning a gun from our listener, Bob in Islip.
Well, I like to look back at, when we talk about the intent of the framers, go back to the early Congresses, and the Second Militia Act in 1792 required male citizens, I believe over 18, to buy certain weaponry and ammunition and all that to be prepared, as part of the militia. Now, I think that was subsequently repealed in 1795, but I don't know why it was repealed, and I haven't heard any mention of that at all.
Well, we looked up the Second Militia Act of 1792, and here's what we found. The actual language, be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that each and every free, able-bodied white male citizen of the respective states resident therein, who is or shall be of age of 18 years and under the age of 45 years, except as is herein after accepted, shall severally and respectively be enrolled in the militia. In other words, everybody who's not too young, not too old, not a woman, and who is white is automatically enrolled in the militia. It then goes on to say, quote, that every citizen so enrolled and notified shall, within 6 months thereafter, provide himself with a good musket or firelock, a sufficient bayonet and belt, 2 spare flints, and a knapsack, a pouch with a box therein to contain not less than 24 cartridges suited to the bore of his musket or firelock, each cartridge to contain a proper quantity of powder and ball, or with a good rifle, knapsack, shot pouch, and powder horn, 20 balls suited to the bore of his rifle, and 1/4 of a pound of powder, unquote, from the Second Militia Act of 1792. So it sounds like our caller was onto something. Joining us now, Mark Graber, a professor of law and government at the University of Maryland, and Jeremy Singer-Vine, who recently wrote an explainer about the Second Militia Act for Slate Magazine. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Professor, tell us more about the Second Militia Act of 1792. I mean, from the language that I just read, it sounds pretty explicit. Congress required Americans to buy products in the private marketplace as a matter of law.
Well, it's even more fascinating because while the focus has been on Section 1, Section 4, which discusses the artillery and the cavalry, actually requires some people to buy horses and very fancy uniforms. Shall furnish at their own expense the color and fashion to be determined by the brigadier commanding the brigade. So it's very clear that the Second Militia Act required people to buy things.
So, Jeremy, go ahead. Did you want to finish your thought?
And a great many things.
A great many things? You mean those things that I listed?
Yeah, not simply the things you listed in Section 1, but for the members of the artillery and the members of the cavalry, much more was required that they furnish themselves. Interestingly, Section 5 says, by the way, there shall be a drum and a fife that the state pays for.
Oh, they'll buy the musical instruments, but not the weaponry to fight the war. Interesting.
Yeah. As a high school clarinetist, I appreciated that.
Yes. As a high school flutist, I would have also. But, we've certainly reversed the priorities between military and arts funding today, but that's another show. Jeremy Singer-Vine from Slate, what do you have to add to this?
Sure, they absolutely did have to buy these weapons, and in a lot of cases, the guns they had to buy were so heavy, so high caliber, that you couldn't even use them for other things like hunting or anything but militia and battlefield operations. So it definitely was very onerous. If you didn't buy these, you could be fined. If you didn't pay the fines, you could go to jail for debt, certainly.
And that law was ultimately repealed, Jeremy?
Not sure whether it was repealed. Eventually, if we step back, the Militia Act said that these citizens had to buy guns, but it wasn't enforced at the federal level. It was never meant to be enforced at the federal level. It was enforced by states. And these states had their own specific takes on the law. Over time, these kind of aggregated state militias proved to be pretty ineffective, especially in the War of 1812. And eventually they came to be replaced by volunteer groups like what today you have as, National Guard, for example.
Professor?
The actual law was repealed in 1903. On the other hand, the previous speaker is absolutely right that it was not enforced, and it's actually rather interesting. The Act of May 2nd has a very, very clear court-martial if you disobey. The material we're talking about is in the Act of May 8th, and there actually isn't a very good enforcement provision with it, so it's not clear whether this was federally enforceable looking at the text.
So, Professor, is that act, in your opinion, particularly relevant or germane to the health care debate? If Congress mandated people to own and buy these things in the private marketplace in 1792, is that constitutional cover for Congress to require people to buy health insurance today?
Well, in one sense, yes, and in one sense, no. In the sense, yes, if you are an originalist, if Congress could require people to buy guns for the militia, Congress could say, we need people who are healthy for the militia. Being healthy requires a health plan. You ought to buy this. On the other hand, if you're not an originalist, you're more concerned with how things developed over 200 years, you might say, isn't this interesting? Isn't this cute? They also wore wigs. Now let's discuss what the Constitution means in our time.
Last word, Jeremy?
Sure. I think the law professors I spoke to said it was pretty clear that this was not applicable. The militia law appealed to the militia clause in the Constitution, which lets Congress provide what it needs for a healthy militia, while the issue at stake with the health care law is the Commerce Clause. They're, in essence, constitutionally independent, or their constitutionality is independent.
But, Professor, isn't there a kind of elastic clause for regulating the economy for the greater good?
Well, there is a necessary and proper clause. I think the crucial thing is it's true Congress passed this under the Commerce Clause, but if you take the act seriously, Congress could simply say, well, we're now going to pass this under the Militia Clause, and the act clearly says Congress can determine who's in the militia. We now determine everyone's in the militia. We also need a healthy militia. Part of being a healthy militia is you need health care, dot, dot, dot. And I think we get to the Health Care Act only by a different route Congress took, because Congress wasn't really concerned with what happened in 1790.
Fascinating. And we'll see if this all actually comes into play in court, perhaps the Supreme Court, as the individual mandate continues to get challenged. Mark Graber, professor of law and government at the University of Maryland, Jeremy Singer Vine, who recently wrote an explainer about the Second Militia Act for Slate. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And those are our follow-up Fridays for this week.